Hello, and welcome to the Original Content Podcast. I'm Anthony Ha, and I am joined today by Brian Heater. How's it going, Brian?
Hello, friend. It's going well. Thanks for having me, friend.
I feel like these introductions, it always feels a little stilted because, as anyone who knows us knows, we literally sit, maybe for this podcast, we should say back to back. So there's just this sort of constant ongoing conversation where we're just sending each other stupid links. Mostly it's you sending me stupid links, but then we have to like pretend we're having a real conversation now.
I thought you were going to say for anyone who knows us knows that we're close personal friends, but that works too.
We're not friends. I'm sorry.
Oh. Well, that's a real... You could have told me at the end of the podcast. That's a real rough way to start.
I wanted to save a bombshell for, you know, for the content. For the content.
Yeah. Is one of us going to evaporate into dust at the end of the show?
No, only just in the middle during our Avengers discussion. So I should mention, we are going to, because we've taken a couple of weeks off for Thanksgiving, and then because Jordan and I were traveling.
And Canadian Thanksgiving.
Yes.
And Mexican Thanksgiving. All of North America, really.
Any excuse not to record. We had a big conference last week in Berlin, so Jordan and I were out of town. But we're going to catch up on all of that right now, and then we're going to review The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which is a new movie on Netflix directed by the Coen brothers.
Yes, I agree with all of what you just said.
It's all factually accurate. So first of all, let's start with some news about Netflix, and there's sort of like two stories that are like the mirror image of each other. One is Daredevil actually has been canceled on Netflix, and it's part of like this ongoing trend of these different Marvel shows on Netflix getting canceled. Luke Cage has already been canceled. Iron Fist has been canceled. There are going to be at least one more season of Punisher and Jessica Jones, but I think most people kind of believe that's probably going to be the end of it. And then people also thought Friends was leaving Netflix, but it turns out that was a false alarm, and it's going to stay on Netflix for at least one more year. And the reason these things are kind of tied together is because it's part of this broader landscape of different streaming, like different media companies launching their own streaming services, and then potentially stuff getting tied up in these, you know, goals of exclusivity of Disney saying, hey, we want all these characters for our service. Warner Brothers saying, hey, Friends is a big asset, which I'm not sure how true that is. And we want that exclusive, you know, potentially having thought at first that they wanted that exclusively for their own streaming service.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the key difference between Daredevil and like Iron Fist, for example, is Daredevil was a show that people actively enjoyed and engaged with. So it's pretty surprising that it's going away from every standpoint except for this this kind of exclusivity one. Obviously, Netflix is trying to like put up the barracks before Disney comes in and, you know, wipes away like a third of their subscribers. I disagree with you from the standpoint of I think Friends is actually a huge asset. I think shows like Friends, the Office is a really good example. Probably like Cheers and Frasier to a lesser degree, but I do think that this probably accounts for a huge amount of what people actually watch on these streaming services. Obviously, like original content is a big thing, and it's growing, and it's given name to this specific podcast. But if you really consider the passive way in which so many people engage with these streaming services, so much of it is just kind of putting something familiar on in the background and binging on it.
No, I think that's right. And that's totally a fair point. Part of it is, I think, maybe pulling apart slightly how these companies are thinking strategically about A, what makes somebody subscribe versus what makes somebody stick around, and what do they actually spend their time on? And I think, and again, I mean, so part of this is me admitting that I've never seen a complete episode of Friends, and there's a good chance that I never will, and I'm totally comfortable with that. But I think there's an element of, maybe there are some people who are hardcore fans, and they will sort of go wherever Friends is, and they'll sign up for a service because it has Friends. And then there's also the question of, okay, well, you know, I like Netflix more because I can get Friends there. I can get, in my case, you know, Star Trek there. I was sad when Buffy the Vampire Slayer left Netflix, but it wasn't enough for me to go and sign up for Hulu, although I did eventually sign up for Hulu, but that was for separate reasons. So I guess that's what I mean by, you know, it not necessarily being an asset, like, that you don't I guess what it sort of leaves a little bit of a bad taste in my mouth is this sense that these, you know, pieces are being, I mean, obviously they're, you know, these companies are all businesses, but that it, everyone just sort of builds up these walls and just sort of tries to hoard all this content to themselves because that's how they think they can sell more subscriptions.
I mean, the one thing I will say is, you know, again, 100% that paradigms are shifting and the business models are shifting. And, you know, if they weren't, all these companies wouldn't be spending billions of dollars a year to develop these shows. But, you know, I know the reason I signed up for Netflix originally and have signed up for a lot of these other services originally was for this second run content. You know, I mean, this is I've been a Netflix subscriber since the envelope days, and that was all they had. There was a long time that they didn't have this original content. So I do think it is still a pretty big asset. I don't know. I mean, I think you're right from the standpoint of I don't know how many people are doing it specifically for that, but I mean, it is a big piece of that puzzle. You know, the one thing I think that is sort of, I don't know if troubling is the right word, but the one thing I do see on the horizon with this idea of them hoarding content is it really does. This is something I've addressed a couple times on the site. I wrote a story about this a while ago when, you know, Disney was launching their service and like four or five other networks, everyone else was launching basically their own walled garden. Is it really does feel like we're moving back to the cable model. You know, it does. It feels like we're moving back to this thing where, you know, rather than just having sort of like one content service or, you know, one or two content services, that in order to get all of the stuff that we're going to want, we're just going to really have to kind of subscribe to these piecemeal. I mean, a friend of mine does a podcast, John Roderick does a podcast, Roderick Online, and they coined the term leeches to describe all of these things that, like, over time you slowly start subscribing for. It's funny. Well, I mean, it's funny in retrospect, but, you know, Anthony, as you know, I was recently in Asia for a couple weeks, and about 2 or 3 days into the trip, I lost my debit card, which is, you know, yeah, horrifying for all number of reasons. But the one thing about it that was really interesting, you know, aside from, you know, again, trying to survive in a hostel in Hong Kong, was if you've ever had to cancel your card or, like, you know, even like renew your card, all of a sudden you start getting all these notifications from the services that you've signed up for over the years. In many cases, things that you kind of forgot about that your credit card was declined. It's a good opportunity to sort of like go through and cull all of those services. And we're definitely moving to that, you know, between all these apps and then all these streaming services, people are going to be, you know, it's going to be like death by a million, you know, $4.99 and $9.99 cuts a month.
It's interesting because I think it is this world which, in a lot of ways, at least in the short term, is better for the content creators, that, you know, there's just so many shows getting made right now. And I think there's ultimately something healthy about the idea that, you know, Ted Sarandos and the team at Netflix are not the only ones who decide what you get to watch. But as a consumer, it's very frustrating because it means there's sort of this cost-benefit analysis all the time of, okay, like, this service has this. Is that enough for me to sign up on a recurring basis? Or is it, and that I'm just going to have to do without that for a while? Or am I just going to sign, you know, for example, I signed up for CBS All Access for the months that they had the new Star Trek show, but then I immediately canceled. And maybe when season 2 comes back, I'll sign up again. But it just becomes this giant headache.
Yeah, I mean, the real difference in the business model from the end consumer standpoint is previously you were paying with your dollars from the standpoint of, like, you know, these are the movies. These are the movies that I'm going to on opening weekend. These are the movies I'm paying box office for. You know, now it's a case of companies basically throwing everything at the wall right now, which is very, very much the case of Netflix. If you look at their content roster, it's really all over the place. And you know, frankly, does appear to be what Apple is doing at the moment as well. Now, you know, I do feel like my $9.99 or however the hell much it is a month that I'm paying for Netflix is going to paying for it. Remember Marco Polo, which at the time was like
Marco Polo.
which was the most expensive Netflix show at the time. I don't know if that's still the case. The fact that there was not only that one Bright movie, but that there are two sequels coming out. You know,
we'll
these are
see if
these
that
are...
actually happens. I mean, they've announced them. I'm not
okay.
They're actually going to go through with this.
All right. A small point, but I mean, you get where I'm going with this,
right.
Which is just like Netflix's fees keep going up, and it's for this original content. You know, and it's costing us, you know, this sort of experiment that they're doing right now is we're basically the ones who are paying for it.
Although I think in Netflix's case, I think that's partly true. And I remember sort of being kind of cranky when I saw these announcements saying Netflix is going to spend this much money on original content. And they expect, I mean, I think that licensed content still is an enormous part of their budget, but it's obviously the directionally that part shrinking relative to the original content spend. And I agree with you that part of what I like Netflix for is not so much for, you know, some pretty good shows and some really not good shows, but also just this, you know, the breadth of the library. But I think they also kind of had to do it. I think they kind of like realized where that every other studio was going to want to launch their own service. Was it, or if they're going to continue selling stuff to Netflix, they were going to sell it for a lot more money. And so I think Netflix knew that if they were going to survive, they were going to have to build up their own, you know, library of content that they were weren't going to have to negotiate for every couple of years. But before we get too far into that, maybe one last thing to touch on this topic, though, is just, did you actually watch Daredevil?
I didn't. I'm really bad at keeping up on TV shows. This was this relates back to the conversation about the main topic for the show. I have this idea that I'm going to save things that I want to watch, like for when it's right, like. But Buster, you know, like we'll get into this later, but like I'm a huge Coen Brothers fan. I mean, they're you know, among my favorite directors of all time. And I was like, you know what? I'm jet lagged from all this travel in Asia. I'm really tired. I don't know if I'm really going to enjoy it. And the only reason I ended up actually watching it this week was because we had to do this podcast. And I'm glad I did and I enjoyed it. But like, yeah, no, I'm behind on like everything I should be watching. And it's the one. We talked about this offline, but as you mentioned before, our backs often touch at work. One of the advantages of flying as much as I do is I get to catch up on this. So a highly belated recommendation for Sharp Objects.
Yeah, no, Sharp Objects is great.
Which I watched on a flight from Hong Kong to New York. I watched all 8 parts of the show.
Well, now you are ready that you can listen to the original content episode where Jordan and I reviewed it. It's a great, great episode of the show.
Classic.
Well, I think part of the reason I bring that up is because I hope I'm not like outing you here, but even though you are a serious comics fan, probably the most serious comics person on the staff, you're not actually a big fan of superheroes on screen, with like the one notable exception of Thor Ragnarok, which is your favorite movie of all time.
Okay. I enjoyed it very much. It was easily one of my favorites of last year. We don't need to go into that here. Also,
we don't Black not Panther. Need to go into it.
Black Panther was also stellar. I want to go on record saying that as well. I don't know. You're right. Like I read a lot of comics and I interview a lot of comics people and write about them a lot. But you know, as you know, it's a different side of that world. It's more often sort of like indie and alternative creators, what us nerds would call like graphic novels and memoirs and things like that. So I don't actively engage with superhero comics for the most part, with rare exceptions of like, you know, again, when like Ta-Nehisi Coates did Black Panther, or you know, when like Grant Morrison does something new. It's more of a creator basis. I just feel like at this point in my life, I don't have any allegiances to characters, if that makes any sense, in the same way that like
I feel
like,
the same way.
Yeah, in the same way that I really enjoyed Ragnarok, not because I love the Thor character, but because Taika Waititi is an amazing director and it was hilarious.
Well, and I think that also speaks to one of the problems with these Netflix shows. And I mean, I know that in general, I mean, with the exception of a few prestige shows, TV tends to be sort of less creator focused than some other media, but Daredevil in particular, I think had three or four different showrunners over the course of three seasons. So there was also this element of I think honestly that had nothing to do with why it was canceled. I think it was canceled because of corporate politics.
Out of spite.
But like I loved the first season of Daredevil. It's probably my favorite. It's my favorite of the Netflix superhero shows. Possibly my favorite TV show about a superhero. Not that that's a very high bar. But like the Steve.
More so than Legion.
I've only seen a few episodes of Legion. That's my version of I meant to catch up on that at some point. But I think the first season of Daredevil is great. But then even within the first season they changed. Like Drew Goddard created it. Then Steve DeKnight took over as showrunner. And then at the end of the first season he left. And then these new showrunners came for season two. And then they left. And then there's a new showrunner for season three. So it also just seems like, that they aren't – even before this stuff, I think there's been a sense that Marvel TV hasn't done a great job of holding on to their creative talent. I mean, Jessica Jones is probably the most critically acclaimed in the Netflix shows. And Melissa Rosenberg, who is the showrunner there, I think she already announced that she's leaving after the third season, which, I think is just another sort of nail in the coffin of, definitely there's no reason for Jessica Jones to come back after season three. But the first season, watch first season of Daredevil. It's good.
What I find interesting about it, and one of the things that I think does compel me to at some point in my life perhaps catch up on some of these, is again, nothing about the specific superheroes. Although I do think, as far as basing superheroes around shows, they picked pretty compelling ones for different reasons. But is the idea of having due to the constraints of the platform, largely budgetary constraints, obviously you're not going to spend the amount of money on a Netflix show, perhaps aside from Marco Polo, that you would on a Marvel movie, is this sort of like tight focused version of a superhero. I mean, one of the things I think that has turned me off to a lot of the superhero movies is the same thing that's turned me off to just generally a lot of these big budget Michael Bay style movies, is they do just sort of really easily trickle down into the realm of just being sort of large explosions, like super action focused. And I do think that this affords the opportunity to have obviously this one kind of superhero element of the storyline, but really focus on characters and plots in ways that you're not necessarily able to in larger films. I mean, perhaps this is let's use this as a transition into the next one. But one of my issues with the latest Avengers movies was that for obvious reasons, they felt like they had to cram so much plot and so many characters into a single film. I mean, this was a way of tying up, in some cases, ending several of the ongoing franchises within the universe. And, you don't get a lot of character development. I do think that Thanos is one of the most interesting supervillains in the Marvel universe, but I don't feel like we really got an opportunity to see that, aside from him, repeating his whole thing about killing half the population, literally probably dozens of times over the course of the movie. You do get the opportunity to sort of to kind of simmer in a character and a storyline in episodic television in the way you don't get to in a 2-hour or in some cases 3-hour long film.
Yes, and I think that, the Netflix shows had varying degrees of success, but I think that's definitely what they tried to do. Let's go with that transition that you gave us into the new Avengers trailer, which, as we record this, went live this morning. And it was sort of strange because there wasn't a huge buildup. It just sort of went online, even though I think there was a period a week ago where everyone thought the trailer was going to go online. And
I mean, there was a buildup in that people have been talking about just the title alone for months now.
Right. Well, that's the other aspect is I still remember I got to go to a press screening for Infinity War, and I stayed till the end of the credits because I assumed they were finally going to tell us the name of the next goddamn Avengers movie, and they didn't. And
in you saw Samuel Jackson's Palm Pilot.
Yeah. It was, oh, God. And so they've like continually held off, and even when they put this trailer online, if you go to the, I mean, of course, I think anyone who's online at this point knows the title, but if you just go to the YouTube listing that Marvel posted, it just says Avengers trailer, and so you have to watch to the end of the video to see what the title is. And after all of that build up, the title is Avengers Endgame. And I just, it's fine, whatever.
Yeah, I guess it does sort of like get across the like quasi-religious aspects of the last movie, of this sort of that the whole like the whole left behind part. It does feel like apocalyptic, but apocalyptic from the standpoint of like Book of Revelations.
Yeah, although I don't necessarily think of Revelations and Endgame in quite the same breath, but I see what you mean.
I just see like Kirk Cameron, you know, being vaporized.
No, I think so. I think the one thing that makes me optimistic about this, you know, I guess probably not the final Avengers movie, because these movies make insane amounts of money, and so they'll probably keep making them. But the last Avengers movie with this set of characters is that at the end of Infinity War, half the cast, or more, I think more than half the cast, kind of disappears. And so I'm hoping that actually, I don't think there's any movie version of this movie that's like a masterpiece, but that a movie that is at least a little bit more character focused, that has, you know, that actually gives time to say goodbye to some of the actors who this is probably their last Marvel film. I'm cautiously optimistic, I would say.
It was just such, I mean, name aside, it was such an underwhelming trailer. I don't know. It was, let's embed this tweet in the show notes. But
your tweet,
you know, I set the trailer to like a particularly emo sounding Green Day song. Of it's like, I don't know how much of it's gonna be like Tony Stark just lost in space. I the one thing I will say is that that's kind of interesting is I do like the idea of giving some sort of redemption to kind of some of the more underutilized isn't even the right word, but like some of the non-fan favorites. Like I do kind of like the idea that like the Marvel universe is going to be saved by Hawkeye, Black Widow, and Ant-Man.
Yeah, the fact that they saved, I mean, I was less struck by the sort of big hero moment for Hawkeye in the trailer, because I mean, I don't really care about Hawkeye, but I was definitely...
No, literally no one does.
Yes, but I was
maybe
surprised
Kevin Smith
when he wasn't in the in the first in Infinity War. But yeah, when
he was spending time with his family, I think.
I think that's right. And I think they also just, even though that Infinity War is so overstuffed and so there's so many people in it, I think they did actually reach a point where they were like, okay, we can save some of these people for the next one.
Yeah.
But
that was some more of the binging that I did on the plane, was I finally watched the two Peyton Reed Ant-Man films. You know, and it will be interesting to see how he escapes the quantum realm.
I assume that'll last for all of 30 seconds.
Yeah. Ant-Man's one of those characters who, you know, if you really pull the camera out a bit, I mean, the ability to not only get super small, but super large, like you could do some damage.
That's true. Yeah.
I don't know. Like here's what I'm saying is like Hawkeye can shoot an arrow, like really, with a lot of accuracy. And Black Widow, what is she? Just like, she's like just trained in like hand-to-hand combat, right? She doesn't even really have a superpower.
That's correct. That's true of both her and Hawkeye. Yeah.
I thought he was almost had like a mutant ability to, are we sure that he doesn't have any sort of supernatural powers?
I can't say anything about the comics. I mean, I've read the Matt Fraction Hawkeye comics and but I don't know, like, early
I'm Googling
Hawkeye
comics. Superpower, so keep talking.
But I think in terms of the Avengers movies, I'm pretty confident that, I mean, we don't know anything about him, really.
Okay, you're right. Yeah, Wikipedia confirms. I thought he had. I thought he was almost like a mutant who was just really good at bows and arrows.
But this is like a common superhero complaint. The complaint about superhero teams is when, you know, the sort of the members of it are sort of mismatched power wise. Yeah. I think with the X-Men, there's always this question of like, why is Wolverine sort of the main X-Man when he has sort of. I mean, it's great that he basically can't die, but compared to someone like Storm or Professor X, like, he can't really do much. Or even with it, the ones I actually enjoy are, like, the Justice League stories where everyone is kind of like, why do we keep Batman around? And then he has to just be, like, the sort of, the really smart one.
You know what I've always found really interesting about these, and this, like, goes pretty much across the board for these superhero team, both comics and movies, is it... You get this collection of very powerful people, and it always ends up being like, you know, five against one or six against one, right? There's always this one incredibly powerful villain that they all have to take on.
Right, because they don't actually have the time to build up a whole bunch of villains. I mean, they kind of did something different they tried to do a little bit more, I think, in Infinity War, where they tried to build up each of the various henchmen of Thanos, but they
still just Thanos.
Right, but like you're supposed to think, I forgot all the names of the other characters already, but that each of these individual characters could be is powerful enough to be the villain of their own Marvel movie, but they all serve Thanos or something. But they weren't interesting characters. I mean, that's also part of it. Is, you know, I think again, and I say this because this is a part of myself as like a comic book nerd. Is I think there's this sort of obsession with powers and like who's more powerful, and ultimately that's not actually what I think most people give a shit about. And so like, even if you say this villain is the most powerful villain of all time, that's not what makes them interesting. Usually it's actually what they do in the context of the story.
I don't know when I did this, but at some point I think I must have like clicked on a Quora story about like it was one of those sort of like, you know, who would win, like, Juggernaut or the Blob, the immovable object or unstoppable force. And I made the mistake. I must have been logged in at the time, and I think I clicked on one of those. And now I get weekly, sometimes multi-weekly emails from Quora about superhero matchups. And you know what? I have no regrets.
Okay. Well, maybe before we go to any further there, we'll just move on to our next piece and final piece of news, which is about MoviePass, a company that you and I have both written about and both are just enormous fans of. And so I think most people remember, even if it's sort of only in this kind of vague way, MoviePass has had a really rough kind of second half of the year. It looked like they were running out of money. The company that owns them was trying to sell them off because basically it was dragging their stock price down. And so they had to basically go with this really stupid. I don't say stupid in the sense that I think they were trying to figure out the best solution as they were running out of money, but stupid in the sense that I would never want to pay for this system where you basically there's like this rotating list of movies on each day that you can buy tickets for, and it's usually not whatever the big movie opening that weekend is. And then even so, I think there's more complication even after the list, where a movie might be on the list, but certain times and certain theaters might be blocked off. And it just gets very complicated in terms of figuring out how you can actually, you know, what movies you can actually go see. And so now they're sort of going to change that. There's like still a $9.95 plan, although the price might be higher for us, since we're in New York and various other geographies, which is basically what they have now, which is like you pay less and you sort of take your chances and maybe you'll get to see a movie you want. And then there's All Access, which will allow you to see any sort of standard format movie, and then Red Carpet, where you can also include one IMAX or 3D movie.
Yeah, I don't really know what to say about MoviePass at this point, you know, except for understandable from the standpoint of like, you almost can't fault them that they took a very startup-y approach to this, which is like, yeah, we'll figure out how to make money later. I mean, you know, you've been working at TechCrunch for a while, and you worked at VentureBeat for an eternity before that, and you understand how these things work. That so many of these startups are given what seems like basically like an infinite runway before they actually have to monetize. But this was different from the standpoint of they were working with kind of very real world dollars and studio systems and, you know, actual like people buying movie tickets. So they really, again, while it's understandable that they had to shift their model a few times, they basically burned too many of their consumers. And I don't see them ever possibly getting back any of that goodwill, especially when there's a handful of competitors out there. You know, there's, God, I'm going to try to pronounce this on the podcast.
I think I can do it, but no, you do it.
Okay. Go. Well, no. If you know how to do it and you know what I'm talking about, then go for it.
Isn't it Cinemia?
I don't know if it's Cinemia or Cinemia. I guess anyway, I don't know where the accent mark goes, but they're MoviePass's cheap competitor right now outside of like AMC's own proprietary thing. And they've got an interesting model from the standpoint of they're actually doing a lot of white label service. So they're working with a lot of these larger theater chains to create branded versions. And that's actually something that I think can sustain them moving forward. MoviePass has just gotten such a bad name because all of the people who are super into the idea of it were the early adopters. And those are exactly the people who got burned.
Even for those of us who didn't try, there was something about, I mean, you were talking about this idea that you're used to, that, you know, we accept that sometimes stuff doesn't make money and then it gets big enough and they tweak their model and then they do make money. But there was something particularly transparent about the MoviePass model where you just sort of looked at it and you're like, I can do basic math and this doesn't seem to make sense.
Yeah.
You're basically just buying me movie tickets. And this only makes sense if like you use this to build some other kind of business or it dramatically changes once you have enough users. And so there was something that seemed a little kind of cynical. I mean, even in the context of business, which is always a little bit cynical and crass, this seemed particularly cynical and crass. And so I think that, yeah, like you're right. They just for a whole bunch of reasons, don't have that much goodwill, even though I think they genuinely have changed the way that the studios and theaters think about their business. I mean, I think there are, whether or not this is the quote unquote the future of movies, like I still buy individual tickets. I'm perfectly happy to do so. Like, I think that this is going to be a big part of the theatrical business model going forward.
I suspect that what they thought going into it is that the studios and filmmakers are so desperate for a savior in the same way that, you know, Spotify, like it took a while for music streaming services to take off. You know, there was the legal version of Napster, there was Rhapsody, there were all of these different options out there, and you know, none of them really were big successes until Spotify. And what it kind of took for Spotify to be a success was for all of these music labels to really basically crumble under the weight of piracy. And then they were super eager to get on board with a streaming service where at least they would make some money. And I think MoviePass thought it saw the writing on the wall, thought that they would provide this way in which, even though they were making a lot of money, at least people were going out and actively engaging with movies. But I think they overestimated that. I think they also overestimated their ability to pivot into being a movie producing studio. We've seen them do a couple of those, I tell you, I don't have time to watch all these prestige television programs, but I sure as hell have seen Gotti.
And it was great.
It was really great. And I recommend it, and everybody go see it. And you know what? Just, even if you don't sign up for MoviePass, just Venmo them some money.
Yeah. For making the world a better place with,
yeah, just for making the greatest film of is that this year? God, I can't. I don't know. What
I think
year
it was this year. It's been a long year. It's been a long year for
sure.
MoviePass.
Has
yeah. Well, yeah, we'll see what happens. Let's move on then to a movie that isn't quite as good as Gotti, but I certainly enjoyed, which is Ballad of Buster Scruggs, now on Netflix and possibly in a handful of theaters if you live in a major metropolitan area. It's an anthology film, which means there's a bunch of stories within it. So maybe the best way to talk about it is to just kind of give high-level impressions without spoilers. And then if we want, we can dive into some of the individual stories in more detail with some spoilers.
I'd like to actually back up for a second and give some sort of like some background on this. I was just reading up on this a little earlier. Number one, I mean, Anthony, you as a movie buff, you know this, but there's so you're right. It came out in theaters, and I think it made like $6,000 in opening weekends. And I mean, there's a reason why this happens. There's a reason why movies, like, in spite of the fact that they know the vast majority of their money is going to come on, come from them on Netflix, and they know that that's how people are going to actively engage it. And I suspect the Coen brothers are perfectly fine with that. Why would a movie like Buster Scruggs open in 5 theaters?
You mean, should it open in more theaters?
No, versus just going straight to Netflix.
I think so. I think there's a couple of answers to that. One is I think it's a beautiful movie and should
sure. Okay, yeah. There's the engaging with content, but there's a more crass reason for it.
So I think the reason, as I understand it, is primarily because is the Oscars, and I think maybe Buster Scruggs might get nominated for a handful of Oscars, but I think the real reason is that Netflix thinks that Roma has a real shot of being nominated for Best Picture, and so they are doing a serious. I mean, still not like an enormous, but like the most serious theatrical release that they've done for any movie for Roma. And I think that when they announced that, they couldn't completely ignore all of their other movies. And so they're doing sort of perfunctory releases for a handful of other films.
Yeah, I mean, I was getting at the Oscar thing, which is in order to be considered by the Academy. And I wonder how long this is going to continue to be the case. Maybe now that the model is changing, it won't be going on for that much longer, but there is like a bare minimum of theater openings, which is the reason why, if I'm not mistaken, I think The Room opened in like one theater because Tommy Wiseau was so convinced it was going to get the Oscar that year.
There have been other Netflix movies that have opened in a handful of theaters before this, Beasts of No Nation, and I think the Meyerowitz Stories and Okja last year. And really those have not gotten any kind of Oscar buzz at all. And of course, I mean, there's different arguments about why that could be the case. I mean, it could be the movies themselves. I think there's also an argument that if you don't, you can't just put it in one theater in New York, one theater in LA, and then people will say, oh, this is a theatrical release and we should take, there's the requirements element of you just have to put a movie in theaters for it to be considered for an Oscar.
Yeah.
But I think there's also a sense of, is this movie a quality movie that a studio is getting behind? And I think one of the signals of that is putting it in a certain number of theaters, which is why Netflix is getting more aggressive about the theatrical strategy right now.
Yeah, I mean, I do, you know, to be slightly less crass about it, I think that given... So the Meyerowitz Stories was... I can't believe I'm blanking on the name of the director.
Noah Baumbach.
Noah Baumbach. And this is the Coen brothers. So these are very well-respected directors who have made critically acclaimed films who people are huge fans of. So I do think in a place, particularly in a place like, you know, New York and Los Angeles, there is a certain fan base of people who like love these directors. So yeah, why not go see them at the theater on opening night?
Yeah, I think that's true. And it's interesting because, the Coen brothers, unlike Baumbach also, though, they've actually directed movies that are giant hits. I think I can understand why no studio looked at this and said, you know what, this is like going to be, a successful on the scale of, gosh, what was their last Western?
True Grit.
True Grit, right? That actually, True Grit made a lot of money, which is sort of funny. I mean, interesting to look back now because it just doesn't seem like a...
Well, sure. I mean, it had two big stars. It was a well-known story, you know, and Westerns like... People really do enjoy Westerns. This is different from the standpoint of like just, first of all, just being an anthology. There are stars in it, but they play smaller roles, and I don't think they're quite like marquee stars in the same way. But I will say, and this is just, you know, based on hearsay, but my understanding about the genesis behind this film going on Netflix is the Coen brothers just sort of understood from the outset that was going to happen from it. You know, there's some quote from them essentially talking about how and this is fair to some degree that all the mainstream movie studios really care about right now are these blockbuster films. They singled out superhero films, but it's interesting if you really sort of take a look at the movies, the really blockbuster movies that have been coming out over the last several years, even more than becoming blockbusters in the US, I think what most of the studios care about right now is that they're going to recoup their money in China.
Yeah, I think that's true. And this probably is not. I mean, I think it depends on the studio. And I mean, some of the studios have specialty divisions and things like that. So there's, you know, varying degrees of success. And I think I've read an interview with Tim Blake Nelson, who plays mm-hmm. Buster Scruggs and is, you know, generally a delightful actor. And in the few times I've seen him sing, a delightful singer. I think somebody asked him essentially, are you disappointed that this isn't going to be seen in more theaters? And he was again, and I mean, it's all, you know, when you do these sort of publicity tours, there's always a little bit of being diplomatic, but he said like, look, this movie was not going to exist without Netflix. Like none of the other studios were, it wasn't that all these other studios were interested in bankrolling it and Netflix made the highest bid. It was that Netflix was the one willing to make this movie.
I think he's also acutely aware of the fact that like, if it wasn't A, made by the Coen brothers and B, financed by a studio, that I don't think there's much of a chance that the title character would have been played by Tim Blake Nelson. I mean, I love him. He was great in O Brother, Where Art Thou? I like him in everything I see, but like, you know, they would have pushed for a Matt Damon.
I think that's probably true. Or like, whoever the biggest star was, they would have put him in the, you know, like whether the title was The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, you would have seen a big version of, Matt Damon or George.
Oh, Clooney's Bradley face. Cooper can sing.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was busy.
That's true.
Now I'm looking at the list. I guess, is Liam Neeson the biggest star in this movie?
James Franco?
Liam Neeson and James Franco. So, Okay, so context, that sort of context, out of at least pushed aside for now, did you enjoy it overall?
Yeah, I really did. The stories are uneven, which is kind of to be expected, but I think that was maybe part of their charm. It was such a short story approach to these that in some cases, like, you know, it didn't feel like it necessarily had to have like a moral arc or even, you know, necessarily resolution. It was totally fine to just have a character portrait here and there. And I think the thing that I liked the most about it, and I was a really big fan of the Twin Peaks sequel, which not everybody was, and I liked it for a very similar reason in that it was a work of art made by a director or directors whose work I have enjoyed very much over the years, and it was an opportunity to see what they would make without the constraints of a major studio.
I think that's true. Although what I would say, and I also appreciated Twin Peaks, the new Twin Peaks, without loving it, is that I think this still feels like it was something that was made with the idea of being entertaining and engaging and thinking about the audience.
Well, this wasn't 15 hours long.
Right. And then there's also the thing of, I mean, I think Twin Peaks is more than 15 hours long. Two hours and change, which also makes it go down a little easier.
This could have easily have been a series if they wanted it to. It wouldn't have had the consistency, and I don't think it would have had the level of involvement that it had with the Coen brothers.
And I do think there is something like freeing about the anthology film, and also like even if it was like a series, like you said. And I was actually looking at some of the original coverage we did around this, and I think, I don't know if this was ever the plan, but it was like written about as if it was going to be a series. So I don't know if maybe that was a possibility at some point. But I think even if you did an anthology where it was hour long or 30-minute episodes around each of these segments, I mean, I probably would have watched that. But I think there's still more pressure that each of them has to be a satisfying story on its own.
Yeah.
Whereas some of these, I think, end in this very deliberately quiet or anticlimactic way. They don't have like the shape of like, you know, like a three-act structure or anything like that. And I think that's great. I think that's why one of the reasons I loved it was like, I'd be like, oh, is that the end? Oh, cool, great. Yeah. And again, I liked some more than others, but the sort of freedom from that sort of traditional movie structure made the whole thing really satisfying.
Yeah, I mean, well, I guess we should start with Buster Scruggs, because it is not only the titular short, but it's also the first one. I, as you know, Anthony, I'm not a huge fan of musicals, but I'm interested in what a musical would look like in the hands of the Coen brothers, and this was an opportunity to do that. I don't know, you know, I don't know that they would have been interested in sustaining that over the course of like 2.5 hours if, you know, they had, instead of doing True Grit, what was that movie, Paint Your Wagon or something? There was an old musical right around the time of True Grit, also starring John Wayne.
Okay.
Yeah, but I don't think that would have been of interest to them necessarily to sustain it over the course of a full film. It worked really well in this short, you know, in this short format. Part of the reason of which is because there was a very humorous conceit to the breaking out in song, and I don't know that that particular joke could have been sustained. I don't know how much, like, are there spoilers on this?
Here's what I would suggest. Yeah. Why don't you say what your favorite and least favorite segment was, and I'll do the same, and we won't talk about spoilers, and then we can talk about whichever one of these you want to talk about in detail with spoilers. We'll do that.
Okay. I'm looking at the list right now. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of them in total. I think my favorite, I'm going to do a tie for each of them. I think my favorite is a tie for Buster Scruggs and the All Gold Canyon, the Tom Waits one.
Right, yeah.
And then my least favorite is also a tie, the Algodonis, Near Algodonis.
Right, the James Franco one.
Stephen Root one, and Mortal Remains, which is the last of them.
Right. Yeah, I would say similar. I have Buster Scruggs and Meal Ticket is my favorite.
Meal Ticket is quite good, yeah.
Right. And then I would say probably Mortal Remains was my least favorite. And even that one I didn't dislike. I think they were going for something kind of very deliberate and mysterious there. And I think it pretty much is what they were going for. I just wasn't terribly interested in that, what they were going for. And also because they placed it last, I think that puts sort of a little bit more pressure on it to be kind of more traditionally satisfying. And I don't think it's that at all.
Yeah, Mortal Remains was, it was more about the mood, I think, than the actual story. And in that case, I was successful. There are some very, very funny moments wherein the Trapper's character just kind of talks for about half of it. It was also it was far and away the most dialogue heavy of all of them, in that the entire thing happened in a stagecoach.
Right. It's well done.
Meal Ticket is a good example of a piece that, like, is also very overwhelmingly about the mood, but has characters that you really care about and is done in a satisfying way.
Yeah, and I think also, I mean, I think even stretched out to 30 minutes, Meal Ticket would not have been satisfying. I think, like, it is pretty much as long as it could possibly be.
No, I mean, you know, perhaps aside from, I guess, giving some background, that was the one thing that I think you do really lack in just about all of these, particularly the last one. Perhaps Meal Ticket and Mortal Remains are the best example of this, in that you're only really getting a snapshot of these people's lives. So it feels unsatisfying from the standpoint of, like, not really quite sure, like, why they're all there. And these are interesting characters. And you know, how did they get to this point in their lives?
Yeah, I think they seemed like they were doing something very deliberate in both of them. And I think it was a lot more effective. I mean, I wouldn't have minded knowing a little bit more about the characters in Meal Ticket, but I also liked this sort of sense of essentially no context whatsoever. And I mean, I guess essentially no dialogue except for some of the recited dialogue and one or two things from Liam Neeson.
Can I make a controversial statement?
Yes.
Okay, so write down the timestamp.
Okay.
I think Joel and Ethan Coen are very accomplished filmmakers who are very good at their jobs.
I agree with that. Yes. I mean, well, it's interesting because I think I never dislike their movies, but there are some of their movies where I will.
No, they've made some stinkers. Lady Killers was really bad.
I've never seen Lady Killers.
Yeah. There's a couple in there, you know, around the aughts that weren't. What was the movie with Catherine Zeta-Jones and George Clooney?
Intolerable Cruelty.
Not great.
Yeah.
But I think what you're getting at is even the sort of more slight ones, like Burn After Reading is a good example of this. It's still an incredibly satisfying film.
Right. Well, I guess maybe one other thing that's interesting to talk about holistically is that I think, and I was actually having this argument with one of our colleagues, John Schieber, was that there's sometimes the way that the Coens get talked about is as these sort of masterful but kind of cold filmmakers, and so that you don't necessarily like empathize too much with the characters, and that's not necessarily the point of the films. And I don't think that's ever been my experience. I mean, and I think the movie that he and I were talking about was specifically was Inside Llewyn Davis, which is probably my favorite Coen Brothers movie.
Oh, interesting.
I don't, you know, I know, I think a lot of that is for like personal reasons. I'm not going to make an argument that it's actually the best. It's just the one that I find the most emotionally resonant. And I think that's a movie where some people can watch that and feel very separate from and judgmental of Llewyn Davis. And then I watched it and like identified with him very closely. And I mean, he was obviously like a shitty person in a lot of ways, but found it very moving for that reason. And I think, I mean, there's certain similar discussions around like Fargo, like to what extent you're supposed to find the characters funny or versus empathetic. And I'm curious, like, to what extent did you feel like there was any kind of stronger emotional response to these stories versus just kind of being like, oh, this is like very clever and well done and, you know, well written.
That's interesting. So let's isolate Meal Ticket, and I mark this for spoilers.
Okay. All right, so, we're starting spoilers now. We think you should watch this movie. Go check it out. And I mean, honestly, like most of these, I don't think they're that spoilery. But if you don't want to be spoiled, stop listening now.
Yeah. Okay. So it's safe to say that although we don't see it, that he hurls the artist, I guess he's known as,
right.
Liam Neeson,
right.
The impresario, hurls the artist in off a bridge into the river. Right.
Mm-hmm.
We're led to believe that.
Yeah, I mean, because the wagon is empty at that point.
I think that that's a pretty good distillation of what you're talking about. There are some cases, you know, Burn After Reading might be, to go back to that, might be a good example of this, where, again, it is kind of a slight movie. So I think they do so many movies that it's okay just, you know, doing one that just kind of, that was like a farce, you know, it was like a classical farce. It was more about the sort of the story and the humor than it was about character development. Meal Ticket, I think, plays really well into this idea, which is that we do have these interesting and sympathetic characters. But the fact of the matter is that they're in a non-sympathetic world, that they that just because a character is sympathetic doesn't mean that their end, that their resolution necessarily needs to be a sympathetic one. You know, the Coen brothers do a really good job of creating, Margie in Fargo is, you know, easily the most sympathetic character in a movie full of really terrible people. And in a lot of cases we do get these characters, but the Coen brothers, in spite of having worked within the studio system, aren't always interested in giving us a happy or even like full resolution in a film.
Right. Well, I think also in Meal Ticket, it's interesting because I think I could certainly in my head imagine how the Liam Neeson character, the impresario, which I feel very silly saying out loud, I could imagine what his justification would be for why, you know, he wasn't just being purely selfish and that potentially maybe he felt like it was more merciful to kill the artist than to just like leave him on the side of the road or to part ways or whatever. But I also like the thing I like about it is that you don't know, like that you have to sort of create all the explanations in your head. And instead you just get this very, very tiny glimpse of what their relationship is for this brief period of time. And then like you said, there's just not. It's not like satisfying in a traditional way. But it is, I think, in some ways more satisfying because you have to sort of project so much into it.
I think it's interesting the way they turn the Hollywood trope on their head, and in this case, the other character has a very particular set of skills.
That's right. By the way, that actor, I suspect this won't mean anything to you.
I looked him up. He was in Harry Potter, right?
Yes, he was. He's played the sort of monstrous cousin and monstrous and overweight cousin who bullies Harry Potter in the early Harry Potter stories.
They did a really good job in the casting of this, in that, you know, there were some familiar faces. I don't think anybody off the top of my head maybe James Franco, but I don't think anybody was miscast. I think there were a lot of like actors who we hadn't seen before, and in the case of wherein they were familiar, they were cast in really interesting, surprising ways. Like, just to sort of go down the list, like David Krumholtz, who has been in like so many things, was in the second Addams Family movie, and has like, he's a character actor. Look him up. He's been in lots of
Serenity.
Things. Was just like plays a guy in the saloon. Stephen Root, who has been in a lot of Coen Brothers movies and I think might be one of my favorite character actors of all time, is in there. Although he does play pretty close to character. Tom Waits, like, what? it took me. It wasn't until we talked about this before. Like, he's unrecognizable. I recognize in the minute he started talking because his voice is very familiar. But like, yeah, of course he's a gold prospector. Like, that was the part he was born to play. Tyne Daly, who is an actor who I don't think everyone would know, but she's probably most famous for being in a kind of procedural CBS cop show called Cagney and Lacey, was in the last one, is cast really well in there as sort of the kind of like prim and proper woman. The casting was just like, I mean, they always do a really good job of casting, and the casting was just phenomenal all around.
I also really liked Clancy Brown in Ballad of Buster Scruggs. He's another one of those guys who's been in a lot of stuff. I mostly remember him as the drill sergeant in Starship Troopers, and he plays Curly Joe, who is only very briefly in Buster Scruggs, but has a fairly memorable role and memorable death.
Apparently, he plays Mr. Krabs in SpongeBob SquarePants.
All right. Well, you know, good.
Does that
good
not mean him. Anything to you?
I've never seen SpongeBob SquarePants.
It's. I mean, you'll. I was gonna say you could probably still live a full life, but I'm not sure that's entirely true. He plays SpongeBob's boss at the Krusty Krab.
Yeah, he's great, and he's only in this movie. He probably worked a day on this movie, but he did good work on that day.
Yeah. This was really fun. I enjoyed it thoroughly, and I hope the Coen brothers, well, I was going to say I hope they keep making movies in this way, but, you know, I think it'd be great to just see them kind of split their time between doing, you know, their sort of larger movies and doing like these kind of like smaller things for platforms like Netflix.
I feel like part of what they do is, you know, no two movies that they make in succession are very similar to each other. Yeah. And this is sort of just kind of an extension of that.
Yeah. I mean, that's usually sort of more to do with the plot, and they do a really good job of switching up, like, you know, the comedic and the dramatic. But this is interesting again, because it's an anthology. So it's just, it's a completely different take on the format.
Well, so I think some of the reviews have talked about it, that besides being linked by, you know, the West or the Western setting, is the idea that all the different stories are in one way or another about death. And I kind of see that. I mean, I don't know that it's like seriously about it. It's just they're all sort of like have this sort of morbidity to them.
Wait, okay. But freeze for a second. Name a Coen Brothers movie that isn't about death.
Inside Llewyn Davis.
Okay. Still, in the minority. I mean, if you scratch the surface on most of them, they're all pretty much about death, and whether it's like murder or mortality.
I think that's fair. I would say that I thought that I liked All Gold Canyon partly because it didn't. Because also, like, to put it more bluntly, because we're in spoilers, like, most of these stories end with the protagonist or the most sympathetic character dying. I liked All Gold Canyon because it was the exception to that. And I think one of the reasons I was less crazy about the gal who got rattled, even though I liked long stretches of it, was I felt like to try to get to the ending that they wanted, it felt kind of arbitrary and manufactured. And so I was less crazy about, you know, just sort of like the Native Americans kind of coming out of nowhere. And I know, and there had been some discussion about that possibility, I think, throughout the course of the story and in some of the other stories. But it really felt sort of, you know, random that it happened then.
It was less about that, like, you know, and that's something that, like, I don't know, it's problematic, but it's such a important part of the the Western to, you know, have them be part of the storyline. But, you know, like, again,
well,
like,
there's two elements that are probably, one is just, so I think from a narrative structure perspective, just, it just sort of like, oh, it felt like that kind of was just kind of came out of nowhere. And then there's also the perspective of, yes, the only Native Americans in any of these stories tend to be these, you know, wordless, you know, sinister force that kind of comes out of nowhere.
Sure. But that aside, my biggest problem with it wasn't any of that. And this is the part of the podcast where it would always be nice to have Jordan on is the, okay, so first of all, because these are Westerns, they're almost entirely cast by male actors.
Yes.
You know, that's, again, a tough thing to get around if it's not, like, the Quick and the Dead. And, you know, again, like, even, like, Westworld, like, most of the female actresses are playing, albeit robots, but, you know, prostitutes in the Old West. The only stories with female protagonists, lead characters were the last two. Mortal Remains, again, has Tyne Daly doing a very good job, but she's just playing sort of like a prim and proper woman who just gets offended by everything everyone says. The biggest issue I had with the girl who got rattled was the Zoe Kazan character. Again, she did a very good job in the role, but the way in which the ending comes about is just all of a sudden you see her with the dog on the back of the horse laughing at prairie dogs. And she's basically the instigator who does the very stupid thing that ultimately gets her killed and almost gets the other guy killed. And that's the issue I had with it, is like, she's this interesting character. And then in order to further the plot or end it, she just makes this really stupid mistake.
Yeah, I think that's true too. Yeah. I think there's a lot of things about the ending that just don't quite add up.
The Coen brothers have really interesting relationships with female characters, because you look at a movie like Fargo, which obviously, like, you know, one of them is married to Frances McDormand, but like, it's just like, is this awesome lead character. And then oftentimes you get these movies from them, or even like Holly Hunt's character in Raising Arizona. They've had awesome female characters throughout. Holly Hunter, not to be confused with Helen Hunt. they've had them throughout their careers, but then, like, a lot of their movies are just sort of like very much just dude centric.
I think that's true. I mean, I think that usually there are interesting women characters in most of their films, but you're right that they tend to center on men. I mean, they've done so many movies, I'm like sort of going back through in my head now, but I think that's a fair statement that, you know, that they're not, it's not necessarily a strength of theirs, although they do have some really interesting, and of course the fact, I mean, Fargo, I think just kind of carries so much weight in that area.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's easy when, like, you're working with Frances McDormand, like, you know, say what you will about Three Billboards. God damn, she was so good in that movie.
Yeah, I love Three Billboards. I understand the criticism.
Yes, I also enjoyed it. But movie. Yeah.
But I guess that also makes me wonder about, and again, I'm not an expert on the, you know, the historical West, but to what extent is this movie supposed to take place in something that's even, you know, supposed to be representative of that, or to, is it supposed to take place in this sort of, you know, cinematic idea of the West? And I guess I probably, again, because of like the role that the Native Americans play, I was also thinking about just, you know, the fact that it's so white, and what I understand is, you know, historically Hollywood Westerns are very white, but actually that's not what the West looked like. I mean, obviously there were a lot of white people, but there were a lot of people of color as well.
Yes. Agreed.
Well, I think we're coming up on, we've gone a little over an hour now. Is there anything else that you want to talk about?
No. Beautiful movie. Well done. Absolutely worth your time. I'm sad that it ended. It was one of those ones that, like, the one reason I would have liked to have had it been a series is because it would have been nice to have it go on for a little bit longer. It's great. Everybody's great in it. Hope to keep doing them. Good job, all involved.
Cool. Well, thank you, Brian, for joining me, and thanks to everyone for listening. You can always find us on Apple Podcasts or any other podcast app. We always appreciate positive reviews on Apple Podcasts. And Brian, you have a podcast of your own. Why don't you tell us about it?
It's called RIYL. We are 300 episodes and change. I've been doing it for about 5 years now. Just, Anthony, you'll be excited about this. Just published an interview with the lead singer of the Spin Doctors.
I saw that. I didn't listen to it yet.
V. Vale, who is a very interesting publisher out of San Francisco, who does research books, is coming up. Lots of bands. Nick Dernasso, who I believe you're a fan of.
You had a great interview with Tom Tomorrow. Tom Tomorrow went up recently.
That actually led to another interesting interview, which film fans will be into, with Ed Solomon. Do you know the name?
What did he do?
He was one of the co-writers of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Oh, okay.
And also wrote Men in Black. He's a screenwriter. So, you know, we talked a bit about the upcoming Bill and Ted and just kind of working in Hollywood.
All right. Well, everyone should go check it out if they haven't already. And thanks a lot. And we'll be back next week.
Bye.